This is Functional Medicine Update for February 2007, Volume 27, Number 2. Our subject of discussion this month is Hormones, Aging, and Health. We begin with our feature called Hot Breaking News. First, an item on calcium and prostate, and then on lactoferrin. After the Hot Breaking News items, we will consider the merchants of immortality, bioidentical hormones, and aging. Then we move from there to hormones and breast cancer, and using dietary nutrients to metabolize estrogen. We will have a segment called Does High Folate Increase Breast Cancer? Followed by the health risk benefit of bioidentical hormones and how hormones interact with receptors. Our interview this month is with clinician researcher Dr. Bethany Hayes, discussing bioidentical hormones and hormone replacement therapy. Now here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland.
Welcome to Functional Medicine Update for February 2007. As you know, we've changed the format for 2007 to include the first section as Hot Breaking News. Then we move into the body of the topic of the issue, and this issue will be focusing on bioidentical hormone replacement therapy. And we're very fortunate to have as our clinician of the month and expert in this area, Dr. Bethany Hayes, who will be sharing with us her thoughts from her 30 years of experience in the field in the area of obstetrics and gynecology. And then the last section of each month will deal with questions and answers that come from you, hopefully, things that have piqued your interest that you'd like us to respond to. So let's start right into Hot Breaking News. There's really two topics I'd like to cite that I think have some interest. The first is related to calcium and prostate cancer. There is a very interesting number of papers that have appeared recently on the area of calcium intake in males and prostate cancer with the inverse relationship between the two, increasing calcium, decreasing prostate cancer incidence. One such paper was published recently. This was a prospective study of calcium intake and the incidence and fatal prostate cancer. It appeared in Cancer Epidemiology, Biomarkers, and Prevention, Volume 15, page 203 in 2006. And in this study, they found that calcium intake exceeding 1,500 milligrams a day in men was associated, in this case, with higher risk of advanced and fatal prostate cancer. And I think it's a very interesting concept because in the past we have said that higher calcium was associated with a lowered incidence of prostate cancer. The results showed that men with the highest intake of dairy products and calcium were more likely to develop prostate cancer than men with the lowest intake, although the relative risk appeared to be fairly small, the difference in relative risk. Now, why is this? I think that the mechanism that is emerging for very high calcium is that when you get very high calcium, you start depressing the production of parathyroid hormone. You start altering the calcium phosphorus ratios in tissues, and you have altered effect on vitamin D metabolism. In fact, you start lowering vitamin D conversion to 25-hydroxy and then ultimately 1,25-dihydroxycholecalciferol. And we recognize that there is a very strong inverse relationship between vitamin D and prostate cancer that has emerged over the last couple of years to be understood. So men who have low levels of serum 25-hydroxy vitamin D3, which when I say low levels, I mean below 50 nanomoles per liter, are men who have increasing relative risk, apparently, to prostate cancer. And you can drive down the conversion of cholecalciferol vitamin D into the hormonal form through the intake of very high levels of calcium. So there's this probably zone of effective calcium intake that's somewhere between 800 and 1200 milligrams a day, say in males. But when you get above 1500 milligrams, at least from an epidemiological perspective, it appears as if you're on the downside of the bell-shaped curve. Now we'd like, in order to fully answer this question, to see data related to increased calcium intake or different incremental calcium intake in males and the level of 25-hydroxy and 1,25-dihydroxy D3, that would probably better allow us to make this association at a mechanistic level. But just to pass it on to you, at least from the present state of our associative knowledge through epidemiological evaluation, it appears that high level of calcium intake in males is associated with potentially lowered active hormonal form of vitamin D, and it has a higher tracking with regard to prostate cancer incidence. So I think we need to keep our eyes on this, because we certainly know there's a very important correlation between vitamin D conversion to its 125-dihydroxycholecalciferol form and lowered incidence of prostate cancer. And again, for the clinicians, I think we want to emphasize the importance in doing serum analysis of 25-hydroxyvitamin D3. Now the data would suggest that we would like it to be in the range of about 80 nanomoles per liter. Anything below 50 we would consider to be in the suspect area, even though the normal laboratory range often goes down to 20 or below, which most of us in terms of functional vitamin D physiology would consider to be well too low to promote proper function. Let's move to one other interesting hot breaking news, and this is the example of an orally consumed bioactive that then influences gastrointestinal physiological function. And I think we're learning more and more about certain agents that can be administered orally that have functional properties in the GI tract to help normalize gastrointestinal immunological function or mucosal function. And the specific agent I'm referring to here is derived from milk, particularly bovine milk and high in colostrum. It's called lactoferrin. I think you're very familiar with lactoferrin as an iron-containing protein that's found in small levels in the immune fraction of milk. It's a very important agent in milk for inducing proper immune defense in the offspring, and it has a very extraordinary ability to help stabilize immunological function in intact animals that are of older age as well, including humans. So we've seen a recent study actually published looking at Helicobacter pylori eradication. This was an open randomized multicentered trial using bovine-derived lactoferrin, but administered to humans. This was lactoferrin taken with triple therapy shown to improve treatment outcome. And I think this is a really interesting example of augmentative medicine or functional medicine. Lactoferrin was thought once to act mainly as a transport of iron to the blood, but now we recognize that it really has a very powerful effect on immunological function of the gastrointestinal tract and interacts with the MALT, the mucosal-associated lymphoid tissue. As such, in the upper GI, it helps to reduce the potential of opportunistic infection with Helicobacter pylori, which, of course, we know is a very important agent in the etiology of gastritis, gastroduodenal ulcer, and gastric cancer. I think that this is a specific example of a more general theme, and that is that there are agents that are bioactives in various foods that do have immunological reactivity and activity within the gastrointestinal immune system. And this, again, is part of the laundry list of therapeutic potential agents we have in administration to the 4R program, the gastrointestinal restoration program, which has to do with replace, reinoculate, and repair steps. The first R, obviously, is remove, removing allergens and toxic agents. Then the following subsequent three R's are replace. That would be stomach acid and pancreatic enzymes where necessary. Reinoculate are the use of probiotics and prebiotics, and we might consider lactoferrin to be a part of the repair, replace concept, because the fourth R is repair using nutrients such as arginine and L-glutamine, pantothenic acid, vitamin E, zinc to help repair gastrointestinal immune integrity. And I think we'd put the bovine lactoferrin into that category. 200 milligrams twice a day was the treatment dose used in the study, and it was found to improve clinical outcome in patients who had H. pylori infection. So that's the hot breaking news for this month. Let's, if we can, move into the discussion of focus for this issue, which is bioidentical hormones or functional endocrinology. I was very taken by a recent book that won the New York Times Best Science Book of the Year award 2 years ago entitled Merchants of Immortality, authored by Stephen S. Hall. This is a very well-researched book, and it really speaks to the whole nature of the development of our understanding of aging of cells and how that's been appropriated into the biotech community as areas of investment and technology, and ultimately maybe misappropriated or prematurely appropriated into the general sales of probably over-exaggerated pro-longevity or anti-aging. This book, by the way, again, The Merchants of Immortality, was a 2003 book, and you can get it. It's a Huffman Mifflin book available on Amazon. So, Merchants of Immortality, Chasing the Dream of Human Life Extension, and what is real and what is not. Certainly there is a lot that we can say to this that's real and very exciting, and things that are happening at the molecular biology level, the cell biology level, and even in the animal biology level that are very encouraging. And we'll talk much more about those things throughout the course of 2007. But there's also the opportunity for exploitation, exaggeration, and to have people pay money for things that really either don't deliver and lead to disillusionment, or may even lead to potential adverse outcome. And of course, that takes us to another very popularized book more recently, a 2006 publication entitled Ageless, which is subtitled The Naked Truth About Bioidentical Hormones. And I think it's very interesting when we go from a very science-based book like Merchants of Immortality that's highly documented from first-tier publications to a book like Ageless, which is based on anecdote, testimony, and personal experience, which may be an N of one that then gets somehow extrapolated to the population at large. We need to be somewhat concerned, I think, about this ageless concept that we can administer hormones as long as they're bioidentical to those naturally produced in the body in a very safe fashion. And it's only the synthetic hormones that produce adverse side effects or outcomes. I think that particular statement leads people down roads that could be very problematic. And I'm going to discuss that. There are safe and effective ways for utilizing hormone replacement therapy, but to assume that these substances that have very high activities at very low dose on cellular proliferation, cellular turnover, cellular gene expression can be used safely with no worry about overdose is truly a very serious exaggeration of fact. And in fact, it has led to a backlash, as you probably know. A number of press releases and media services have talked about this blow up over bioidenticals. It's seen in almost all of the periodicals now as a major reason for intervention by the Food and Drug Administration. The College of Obstetrics and Gynecology has become so alarmed that they've now mounted publicity campaigns to warn patients about the risk of excessive hormone exposure. I mean, we're really into a very dynamic period of re-evaluation of what is safe and effective as it pertains to hormone replacement therapy in the perimenopausal or postmenopausal woman or in the climacteric male. I'm not speaking here to situations where there is a growth hormone deficiency in children or there is a very significant hormone deficiency leading to a number of the endocrinopathies in adults. I'm speaking now to the kind of natural transition in hormones that occur as a consequence of, quote, normal aging. And what is the level of replacement that would be required, if at all? And if so, what would be used? And those are the topics that we're going to be discussing in this issue of Functional Medicine Update. Just to put this in context as it relates to the risk-benefit safety profile, I want to cite a recent paper that appeared in Journal of the National Cancer Institute, Volume 98, page 1406 in 2006, entitled Endogenous Steroid Hormone Concentrations in the Risk of Breast Cancer Among Premenopausal Women. I want to emphasize these are endogenous levels. So the question that they're asking is estrogen produced by women naturally and all the other hormones that come with it have anything to do with relative risk of breast cancer? We're not talking about exogenously administered hormones. We're talking about endogenous hormones. And if, in fact, estrogen bioidentical was completely safe, then we would say it wouldn't matter whether a woman had high estrogens or low estrogens, then in fact she would be at the same low risk if it's bioidentical, and assuming obviously that the hormones we produce are bioidentical. Well, I think most of you know the conclusions of this study are quite clear. The levels of circulating estrogens and androgens found in women may be important in the etiology of premenopausal breast cancer. And those women who had the higher levels of estrogens are the women who had a relative risk that was about twofold higher than those women who had the more normal levels of estrogen. These are endogenous estrogens is what I'm speaking to. Higher levels of total and free testosterone and androstenedione, these are the androgens in both menstrual cycles, were associated with modest, non-statistically significant increases in overall risk of breast cancer, whereas the increases in estrone sulfate were not seen with increases in breast cancer risk. But if we look then at estradiol, that we had a much higher risk. So estrogen as estradiol, which is a very mitogenic, it's a substance that causes cellular proliferation, does associate itself as an endogenous hormone, bioidentical again, with increasing relative risk. So I don't think we can say hormones at large, but when we start looking at individual contributors such as estradiol, we certainly see that the high levels are associated with increased risk. So I think the concept that bioidentical hormones are safe and synthetic hormones are dangerous is just specious and not correct. It's about balance, it's about metabolism, and it's about cellular activity that really relates to the question of safety versus risk. If we look at ovarian cancer risk, this is the recent association of diet and its relationship to hormone metabolism and cancer risk. I think it's a very interesting evolving story because it seems that one of the major determinants for how hormones interact with the body and ultimately mitigate relative risk is diet and lifestyle. Although we can't necessarily control directly our hormones as they get secreted from glands, we can control the fate of those hormones as it relates to their metabolism, their excretion, their cellular effects, their transport through dietary and lifestyle variables. And this particular paper that appeared again in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, volume 98, page 1397 in 2006, talks about the fact that if long durations of unopposed estrogens and of estrogen plus progestin are associated with increased ovarian cancer risk, however, that these particular types of relative risk can be in part modulated or modified by dietary intervention, going more to a vegan diet with a higher density of phytochemical-rich foods, whole grains, fruits, and vegetables. In fact, many studies have been published. Joanna Dwyer from Boston area has published a number of papers showing that vegetarian women have faster turnover of hormones and have lower estrogen levels. Therefore, they also have lowered incidence of hormone-related cancer. So I think we need to put the diet component in perspective as a very important variable. We also need to look at not just estrogen, but also the balance with androgens, particularly progesterone. And you probably all recognize that there are progesterone receptor sites on virtually every tissue, certainly on breast cells, and that progesterone can be proliferative even in the bioidentical form for cell proliferation. And there's an interesting recent paper that just appeared on cancer link of genes regulating estrogen effect on breast cells showing an interrelationship. So I think we need to be cautious even about the use of progesterone, which is often used to balance estrogen, because excessive progesterone signaling can also induce cell proliferation. I'm talking about bioidentical progesterone here, not progestins, the synthetic variants thereof. Then we start asking, what about various nutrients that are found in the diet and their relative role that they play in either reducing the relative risk to hormone-related cancers or to increasing the risk? And one of the interesting paradoxical observations has been made recently has to do with folic acid. We know that folic acid and vitamin B12 and vitamin B6 and betaine are all very important for support of the folate cycle. The folate cycle is the cycle that generates active methyl groups through S-adenosylmethionine. We know that S-adenosylmethionine then serves as the donor of methyl transfer reactions that are useful through the enzyme catechol-O-methyltransferase, or COMT, to partially metabolize estrogens to form the methoxylated estrogens. This would be like the conversion of 2-hydroxyestrone or 2-hydroxyestradiol into 2-methoxy compounds. These methoxylated estrogens are antiproliferative, and they may be seen as kind of estrogens break. If you think of estradiol as a cellular accelerator, meaning it increases the turnover of cells, the replication of cells, and their division. As you know, in physiology, for every accelerator, you always have a repressor or a break. That's the yin and yang upon which physiology is built. One of the breaks of estrogen's induction of cellular replication is the methoxylated estrogen, 2-methoxyestradiol. So the balance between estradiol and 2-methoxyestradiol is very important in regulating aspects of cellular turnover and cell cycling. The methoxylated estrogen obviously comes from The first step is the hydroxylation of estrogen as the 2-hydroxy compound through a cytochrome P450, 3A4, the cytochrome P450, 1A2, and then that gets further metabolized by methylation through S-adenosylmethionine. So we would assume then that it's desirable for a woman to have proper folate, B12, B6, and betaine nutritional support for proper methylation support of her estrogens, and that has been proven correct in a number of studies, and we've talked about that previously in other issues of Functional Medicine Update. Now the question is, what happens if you get very high levels of folate? Does that have any effect that's continually beneficial, or is there a bell-shaped curve? And this is where the controversy starts to exist. I'm now quoting from a recent review article that appeared in Nutrition Reviews, Volume 64, page 468 in 2006. And the title of this article is, Does a High Folate Intake Increase the Risk of Breast Cancer? Not decrease. So although not uniformly consistent, there is epidemiological series of studies that generally suggest a kind of an inverse association between dietary intake and blood measurements of folate and breast cancer risk. However, the prostate, lung, colorectal, and ovarian cancer screening trial has recently reported for the first time a potential harmful effect of too high a folic intake on breast cancer risk. So we've generally said that the higher the folate, the lower the incidence of colorectal, ovarian, prostate, and lung cancer. But now this new study says that if we get to too high a level, there was a statistical association with an increased risk. In this more recent study, the risk of developing breast cancer was significantly increased by 20% in women who reported supplemental folic acid intake compared with those that reported just normal dietary intake of folate. Although food folate intake was not significantly related to breast cancer, total folate intake mainly from folic acid supplements significantly was associated with increased breast cancer incidence by 32%. So then the question is, why, right? Is there any reasonable rationalization for this? Well, there's no real compelling supportive evidence at this point as to how mechanistically these associations tie together. However, you know, I guess we have to take this with some degree of sobriety because the data was at least published and was of concern. So I think that, again, this story of folate and methylation and the pleiotropic effects of folate and whether there's a difference between folic acid from a supplement versus food folates that are polyglutamyl folates and whether 5-methyltetrahydrofolic acid has a different effect than folic acid, all of these questions, I think, remain to be better understood. But certainly, I think we recognize that folate appears to possess dual modulatory effects on carcinogenesis. We know that folate deficiency has an inhibitory effect on carcinogenesis, whereas high folate has a promoting effect on the progression of established neoplasms. Folate deficiency in normal tissue appears to predispose them to neoplastic transformation and modest supplemental levels suppress, whereas supraphysiological doses of supplementation enhance the development of tumors in normal tissues from a variety of studies that have been published. As an essential cofactor for the de novo biosynthesis of purines and thymidylate, folate plays an important role in DNA synthesis. Folate may also modulate DNA methylation, which is an important epigenetic determinant, as you know, in gene expression and in the maintenance of DNA integrity and in chromosomal modifications as it relates to gene expression and also protection against mutational injury. So we would say proper folate intake is very, very important for supporting proper methylation and these epigenetic effects that folate has, as well as the effects on DNA repair mechanisms. Now the question is, what happens when you give supraphysiological doses of folate? How does it promote rapidly replicating pre-neoplastic cells to increase their cellular turnover and their cell cycling? It appears a mechanism that is emerging, it's still kind of in the early stages, is associated tumor-promoting effect may be due to the enhanced de novo methylation of promoter CpG islands of the tumor suppressor genes with consequent gene inactivation, which could result in tumor progression. I want to again put this in the context that this is early stage news, but I think it's well worth us looking at once again because we know most every substance has a dose response parabolic type of curve. Too low a level is not good. too high a level is not good, and somewhere in the middle is where we should be, and that's certainly true for all nutrients. So as we look at this folate connection, it may not be if a little is good, a whole lot more is better. It may be finding the right folate level to support proper methylation of hormones and proper conversion of homocysteine on into S-adenosyl methionine and the methylated derivatives. Now, how do you clinically evaluate this? One method that's used as a surrogate marker, obviously, is homocysteine. So if you have elevated homocysteine above, say, 8 or 9, then that may be a patient who is then going to benefit from folate B6, B12, and betaine supplementation. You want that homocysteine to be in the range of, say, 4 to 7, 4 to 8, and you can use that at least as a marker, a surrogate marker, for folate B12, B6, and betaine. Let's move from this discussion over to looking at a review of the safety and efficacy of bioidentical hormones for the management of menopause and related health risks. There's a very nice review that was published in Alternative Medicine Reviews, Volume 11, page 208 and 206, authored by Deborah Moskowitz on this topic. And as you probably recognize, when we talk about bioidentical hormones, we're talking about 17-beta-estradiolestrone, we're talking about estriol, we're talking about progesterone as it relates to the contrast with progestins, and we're talking about testosterone. These would be considered your bioidentical hormone replacement substances. When we start examining the relative risk-benefit, certainly I think we have to look at things like route of administration, dose, and formulation. But I believe the overwhelming evidence is that for safe, effective use, bioidentical hormones have a preferential value over those of synthetic hormones if, in fact, we are going to have an individual normalized by replacement for many, many years, as is often the case going through perimenopause into menopause. Now, this does not necessarily connote that all women have to be on hormone replacement therapy, but we're talking about the relative risk benefit based on literature, that it would appear that we have much better evidence that the bioidentical hormones in the right range of concentration administered correctly have a higher safety profile. In terms of administration, there is some interesting new information related to safe administration as well. I'm now quoting from a recent paper in the journal Maturitis, in which they look at hormone replacement therapy contrasting transdermal versus oral hormone therapy, looking at estrogen and progesterone. And in this particular study, they really talk about the transdermal or even the intravaginal administration as having a much more beneficial effect, a safer effect than the oral administration route. That seems to also be true as it relates to a more recent paper that appeared in Arterial Sclerosis, Thrombosis, and Vascular Biology that contrasted the effects of oral versus transdermal estrogen on serum amyloid A and high-density lipoprotein serum amyloid A in postmenopausal women. And as you know, these are proteins, SAA, that are associated with inflammation and also associated with cognitive dysfunctional neuroinflammation. So the question is there any difference between the route of administration of estrogens and the effect they have on SAA, serum amyloid A protein? And oral estrogen was found to increase serum amyloid A and alter HDL composition to contain a higher level of SAA protein, whereas the transdermal administration did not have this same effect. So it again appears to argue for the use of a transdermal estrogen that would avoid first pass conversion in the liver and would have a more favorable effect on cardiovascular outcomes. Again, this is taken from the Arterial Thrombosis and Vascular Biology Journal. This is volume 24, page 164 in 2004. So there's a wide body of literature on transdermal benefit over oral. I don't think I need to take you through all of the data, but certainly we see, as it relates to metabolism, the more favorable effect on inflammation. You see a lot of studies showing elevated CRPs after oral administration, and you don't see that with transdermal administration. We see changes in fibrinolytic activity with oral that we don't see with transdermal. We see adverse changes in lipoproteins with oral that we don't see with transdermal. So it seems to really argue fairly strongly for the transdermal route of administration. Assuming that the woman can absorb this transdermally, and there are different vehicles to help transport, as you know, And then there's also intervaginal transmucosal transport, and Dr. Hayes will talk a little bit about that subsequently in this particular issue. So now we talk about the formulations, and of course that gets into compounding pharmacies and compounding the right formulation, bioidentical hormones and the compounding pharmacy. There's some nice discussion of this in the journal Integrative Medicine, Volume 5, page 58 in 2006. And this is a place where the practitioner can work very closely with the compounding pharmacist to produce a specific formulation that would personalize the bioidentical hormone replacement therapy for that woman. And I think it's important to recognize that personalization is probably what should be done in this case, and not every woman absolutely requires hormone replacement therapy to lead a healthy life. And those that do get hormone replacement therapy, tailoring it to their own specific needs is critically important. And again, Dr. Hayes will go into this in greater detail as part of our Clinician of the Month discussion. In fact, she's authored a very interesting paper that kind of gives an overview to this whole field entitled Giving Menopause Its Proper Place. This was published in Integrative Medicine, Volume 5, page 32 in 2006. And she goes through the whole concept of menopause and knowing about estrogen and where it's going and how it reacts with that woman's body, and then finding the right balance. And she will speak to this in greater detail in our interview with her. We know that it's not just administration of the hormone substances in and of themselves. It's also how they interact with receptors and how these receptors then signal cellular activity. Many estrogen-related receptors are now being seen as targets in cancer and other metabolic disorders. So estrogen has a crosstalk with many other cellular functions, including, as I already mentioned, inflammatory functions, insulin signaling functions, relationships to detoxification. Many cellular functions have in the web of interaction a relationship to estrogen and its reactivity at various receptor sites. There's a very nice review paper on estrogen-related receptors and their relationship to cellular function that appeared in Current Topics in Medicinal Chemistry, Volume 6, page 203 and 206. And I think the very important takeaway is that estrogen receptor-targeted therapeutics now are showing a success in not only the treatment of breast cancer, but also orphan estrogen-related receptors have become novel targets for future development because these are receptors that are different than the traditional estrogen receptor alpha and estrogen receptor beta. We know that ER-alpha is the receptor that's traditionally activated by 17-beta estradiol. It's involved with cellular cycling and it involves cellular proliferation, and it's the receptor that's most often upregulated in oncogenesis. The estrogen receptor beta is more associated with bone metabolism, and this is kind of the differentiation in the SERMs between tamoxifen and raloxifen. Tamoxifen has effects on ER-alpha. Tamoxifen has effects apparently more on ER-beta, although these are mixed slightly as it relates to their modulatory effect as selective estrogen response modulators. But we now recognize that there are effects that compounds have beyond that of just the traditional estrogen receptor alpha and beta, which are called the estrogen-related receptors, or ERRs. These are a very interesting family of receptors whose agonist or antagonist can crosstalk then with the estrogen receptors. And so you might have amelioration of estrogen-related symptoms without ever directly affecting the estrogen receptor with that ligand. We now know that these crosstalks will crosstalk across such processes as cellular detoxification, and that ties together the estrogen activity with things like nuclear regulatory factor 2 or NRF2, which is a ligand-dependent interaction with estrogen that then helps to regulate detoxification functions. So this could be occurring both as a consequence of stimulation of estrogen receptors directly and of nuclear receptors that influence then the gene expression of the detoxifying enzymes. What I'm really trying to say is that if we look at how to modulate estrogen's effects in the body, part of it is modulating the actual level of estrogen in the body as measured by serology or urine 24-hour analysis. And part of it is really regulating the responsiveness of estrogen by how it affects receptors and how it is metabolized and excreted. This takes us into the concept of how diet may influence estrogen, not just directly through modulation of estrogen receptor alpha and beta, but also through these ERR pathways, through the estrogen-related receptor pathways. And in fact, there's a very interesting paper just published in the journal Endocrinology. This actually occurred in the latter part of 2006, November 9th issue, entitled Selective Activation of Estrogen Receptor Beta Transcriptional Pathways by an Herbal Extract, in which they show that some of the bioactive phytoestrogens in various plant foods don't work strictly through ER alpha or beta, but work through these ERR pathways, the estrogen-related receptors that then modulate things like flushing and night sweats without having a direct cell proliferative effect. In fact, recently, a first prospective randomized double-blind placebo-controlled use of a standardized extract to alleviate menopausal discomforts was reported. This is using a substance that is derived from Humulus lupulus, that's hops, and a fraction from the hops plant, so-called the hydrophilic fraction, the water-soluble fraction from spent hops, was shown when concentrated to have a very interesting menopause symptom-reducing outcome without apparently having a direct serious effect on activation of the estrogen ER-alpha mechanism. This was published in Maturitis, Volume 54, page 164, in 2006, and it's a very interesting report of this highly, quote, phytoestrogenic substance from hops. In fact, it's about 100 times more phytoestrogenic than that of genistein, about tenfold less estrogenic than 17-beta-estradiol, but it doesn't appear to have the cellular proliferative effects that does estradiol, so it may work through other mechanisms, through these ERR mechanisms or other kind of crosstalk mechanisms, or even maybe a mixed effect through alpha and beta estrogen receptor agonist activities and these other response elements. What I'm really trying to get you to understand is that the complex diet that contains a rich array of phytochemicals may be one of the best tools clinically for managing estrogen-related dysfunctions or hormone-related dysfunctions in perimenopausal and menopausal women. It may actually be a much safer approach, at least at first step, before we introduce bioidentical hormone therapy because of the complications in trying to measure hormones and stabilize activities when they're given exogenously. By modulating the diet, we may then induce proper cell signaling and allow the woman's natural estrogen, progesterone, or androgens to be properly regulated through hormone binding globulin, through cell receptive mechanisms, and ultimately through cell signaling. So I think that this sets a context for what we want to speak to with Dr. Hayes, which is how do you take all of this extraordinary information that's emerging around bioidentical hormones and apply it in an area that is so in need, with 30 million women going through menopause over the next 10 years, and with the question as to what do I do, if anything, what's safe, what's effective, and what will really give me a better long-term health outcome? It's those questions that we'll be addressing when we talk with our expert, Dr. Hayes. I just want to contextualize this conceptualization that hormone therapy will alleviate symptoms is built around the principle that we understand how those hormones are really signaling their influence, what cells are being influenced, and how we get differential, safe, and effective outcomes. As we really dig deep into this literature, we find that this is still a very early stage of our understanding of the complex web of interactions. And so the concept of do less can do more may be a very good watchword. Maybe rather than jump in and try to do watch repair with a jackhammer, we ought to be treading very carefully using the least aggressive therapy possible to modulate symptoms that appear in women that are adverse associated with menopause. With that then, let's turn to Dr. Hayes and talk about her clinical expertise in this area.
As you know, this issue of Functional Medicine Update, we've been focusing on what I call functional endocrinology, or the relationship specifically in this case to hormone replacement therapy, the bioidentical hormone story. And we're very fortunate to have as our clinician of the month this month an expert in this field, Dr. Bethany Hayes. Many of you obviously know Dr. Hayes. If you're in our field of functional medicine, she is a leader in the area of women's health issues, has been a major teacher at the Functional Medicine Symposia and applying functional medicine and clinical practice training programs, has been an author and is founder and director of the True North Clinic Consortium, which has a functional medicine underpinning in Maine. And I've had the privilege of actually visiting her facility and meeting her colleagues. It's just a remarkable way that functional medicine is applied in a clinical setting using a comprehensive multifactorial group of practitioners to address these very complex issues from a central theme. Dr. Hayes, for those of you not familiar with her background, went to Wellesley, where she graduated with a major in philosophy, which is why she's probably such a good medical doctor, because she started off with the right underpinning, a broad base of the humanities understanding, and then from that went on to Baylor College of Medicine and went on to her OBGYN residency at the Baylor-affiliated hospitals and has been in practice now for more than 20 years. She's a mother of three sons, all adult grown-up children now, and is involved with their complex lives as well. So she's one of these superwomen that has many things going on and seems to do them very adroitly. We can only envy those skills. But Dr. Hayes, it's wonderful to have you as a clinician on Functional Medicine Update and to have a chance to talk about this controversial but very important area of hormone replacement therapy.
Thanks, Jeff. I'm happy to be here.
I want to start, if I could, with three questions or comments or statements that have been made in recent literature that goes out to the general public that often then brings women to doctors to ask for hormone replacement or bioidentical hormone replacement therapy. And I'd like to get your kind of concepts of these three statements, because they're made as statements of fact, and I think we both probably would question the factual veracity. Statement number one is, we age because our hormones decline. Our hormones don't decline because we age. I think I'll take each of these three separately. What's your thought about that statement of purported fact?
Well, I'd like to see some evidence of either part of that statement. The first part is we age because our hormones decline, and I'm not sure that that is a true representation of what's going on. I suspect that our hormones decline in order to allow us to age well. In other words, I think the hormones of our younger years, particularly the premenopausal hormones of women, are toxic level hormones that allow us to reproduce. Then when we don't need to be reproducing anymore, we're allowed to have normal levels of hormones so that we can age gracefully and not end up with the toxicities that those high levels of hormones produce. The second part is that our hormones don't decline because we age. And I think our hormones probably decline in part by intention, as I said, in order to age gracefully. And then there's the abnormal decline in our hormones that are due to toxins in the environment, poor metabolism of hormones, and hormone attack from autoimmune disease that attacks the glands.
So that then segues nicely into the second statement that's been made as if it were a statement of fact, and that's bioidentical hormone replacement is the only answer to ward off illness, weight gain, and other symptoms of hormonal decline that occur during menopause.
Well, I think that's clearly not true, because we all know some 93-year-old women who are sharp as a tack, driving their own cars, running their own households, not obese, not sitting in a wheelchair somewhere without their brains intact. So clearly, it's possible to do that without hormone replacement therapy, if you have the right environment in which to bathe your genes. And that environment would be a clean, balanced diet, movement, stretching your muscles and moving your muscles so that they stay oxygenated and don't tighten up and affect joints, and a positive attitude. I think people stay alive a long time for two reasons. One is because they're very connected to their physiology. And the other is because they're very connected to their future. If you have a reason to be alive a week from now, a month from now, 10 years from now, you're much more likely to be alive then than if you can't see any reason to be alive.
Well, that's a wonderful statement, and I think it then obviously bears on my last little statement that has been thrown out in the universe as a statement of fact, which is questionable, and that's, quote, without hormone replacement, we will end up as mere shells of our former selves, which sounds a little bit like post-Robert Wilson Feminine Forever in the 60s.
It does, doesn't it? I bring to mind this advertisement for hormone replacement from 15 years ago with a woman looking out over parched land, and the title is The Fate of the Untreated Menopause. So I think where we need to be headed here is healthy aging. We need to be looking at what we've done to our environment. We need to be looking at what we've done to our food supply. We need to be looking at what we've done to women to make them feel worthless once they go through menopause.
That's magnificent. So let's move from that discussion, that platform, to what are the players we're really talking about when we talk about hormone replacement therapy. And, of course, there's quite a large array of hormones, but the ones that are most commonly discussed when we talk about bioidentical hormone replacement therapy are things like the estrogens, estradiol, estrone, estriol, progesterone, testosterone. We might include dehydroepiandrosterone, cortisol, thyroxine and triiodothyronine for thyroid, insulin, and maybe even human growth hormone in some subsets. So when we start going down that laundry list, from your very rich experience and now the work that you're doing at True North, how do these different hormone substances fit into a development of a comprehensive program for a woman who is having some complicated symptoms that grow out of her menopause transition?
Well, I think, first of all, women tend to come for hormone therapy because they're having symptoms, not because they're worried about the fate of the untreated menopause. So the symptoms that they're having primarily are problems with their brains. They're having trouble with hot flashes, they're having trouble with insomnia, they're having trouble with cognition, memory, and sometimes depression. The balance of hormones is critical to the function of the brain. And when you note that a third to a half of women have had hysterectomy at an average age of, used to be 35, now it's a little bit older than that, you know that a lot of women either are missing their ovaries, about half of those women, or have had damage to their ovarian blood supply by severing the utero-ovarian ligament at the time you remove the uterus. So a significant proportion of the population are not going through normal menopause. I think another group that we are not yet able to clearly define are women who have autoimmune destruction of the ovary. And the reason we can't define that is because there are so many antigens involved with the ovary that the researchers can't really come up with an appropriate panel of antigens to look for antibodies for them. And so we've largely ignored that as a cause for abnormal menopause. When I see a menopausal woman, the first thing I want to do is measure her hormone levels. And this is an easy thing to do because these hormone levels are fluctuating, particularly at the time when women come in for hormone replacement, which is often in perimenopause and not actually in complete menopause. So they come in and they're having problems, but what they're really having problems with is the inability of their hormones to dance with each other. They don't have enough reserve in several of their organ systems to allow an easy transition to menopause. These hormone levels go up one day, they're down the next, they're up the next day, they're down the next day, and the brain doesn't have time to adjust to those changes in hormones. So they're having symptoms. Because you can get rid of those symptoms by nailing estrogen to the ceiling, by giving high doses of estrogen, we've come to believe that if women have any complaints, you just give them estrogen. And boy, have I seen some women on high doses of estrogen with complications of that. So what I do is start with, let's get a measurement so that we have some idea of what's going on. And I don't just measure estrogen. I measure estrogen, estrone, estriol. I measure testosterone, progesterone, DHEA. I measure sex hormone binding globulin. I measure the 2 to 16 hydroxyestrogen metabolites. I'd like to be able to measure more than that, but that's what I can get reasonably priced and in a pretty well-accepted laboratory environment. So I start with measuring them. Then if they're low, the first question I ask is, why are they low? Are they low because the ovary is missing? Are they low because the ovary is underproducing? Or are they low because that ovary is dancing with another hormone that's too high? In which case, the treatment would not be to raise the level of estrogen, it would be to lower the level of the hormone that's too high. So I go at it in a systematic manner. Then if I decide I'm going to replace the hormone because it's low and because I think I know the reason why it's low, I get informed consent from my patient, because the data in the literature is so constantly changing that, you know, what may be considered standard of care today is going to change tomorrow. So you need to have documentation in your chart that you've talked about these issues with a patient, that they understand the risks that they're taking and agree to those risks. Then we start with low levels of the hormone regimen that I prefer, and then we recheck the levels to make sure that we are in the right range. And that's sort of, in a nutshell, the approach that I take.
Could I interrupt and just ask a question quickly, because I know a lot of clinicians probably would like your answer to this, and that is, in measuring these, obviously you have different compartments you can measure, or different fluids. You could measure serum, you could measure urine, you could measure saliva. Is there a peremptory biological fluid you select, or do you vary that based upon what you're trying to answer relative to each of those hormones?
I do check different hormone levels depending on the hormone I'm checking, but with regard to estrogen, I usually use blood. The reason I use blood is because two things. One is I have found more data in the literature about what normal levels look like. And the second is it's often covered by insurance, so patients can get their insurance to pay for it. I think you can use other fluids to measure those hormone levels, provided you get good at knowing what the fluctuations look like in that fluid, what levels you would expect to find in different clinical settings, so that you know when you're looking at a hormone that doesn't look right. So if I measure a hormone and I'm looking at a woman who's got high estrogen symptoms, and I measure her estrogen level and it's very low, I know I've picked a trough instead of a peak, and I need to perhaps repeat those hormone levels or think through why would her estrogen level be low with symptoms of elevated estrogen.
You've helped us all to really understand that, those of us who have had the pleasure of attending your courses, because you showed some very interesting data in perimenopause that shows exactly what you're saying as it pertains to estradiol levels in a perimenopausal woman who is maybe showing the symptoms of estrogen excursions, and at one point of the analysis her estrogens are very low, but at another her estriol is very high. So, as you said, depending on where you point to freeze frame, you might get a very different sense of what the level is.
That's really true. And I think you have to remember that it's probably the overall area under the curve that's going to influence things like breast cancer and uterine cancer and perhaps bone loss. So when you have an area under the curve analysis of perimenopause, like the one that was done by Dr. Santoro, you see that perimenopausal women early in the transition actually have higher levels of estrogen than they did when they were ovulating and having regular periods. So I think perimenopause is a potentially dangerous time, and it's dangerous because you have higher levels of estrogen, so that if you're not metabolizing them well, you're creating chemicals that can induce breast cancers. And it's dangerous because you will at the same time be having symptoms of this fluctuation of estrogen that produces brain symptoms. And some doctor's going to come along and say, oh, you're having hot flashes, so you must be menopausal, so let's put you on estrogen. And now you've added to the risk.
I think you raised a very important point, again, that we need to probably emphasize for our listeners, and that's the question of pharmacogenetics and metabolism of these hormones. And what's being discovered is there's a lot more variability among people, among women in this case, as to how they process through their bodies these hormones. So the construct that a single dose on body surface area will be tolerated in the same way by all women is really a pretty specious argument. So that argues for your personalization approach, it would seem.
I think that's really true. Now that we have some genomics available to us in laboratories that are clinically available, you begin to see why so many people don't respond the way you expect them to with hormones. And if you are not paying attention to how they metabolize hormones, these are the cytochrome enzymes that are detoxifying enzymes, which implies to me that the human body sees estrogen as a toxin. The other thing that implies that is nanogram amounts of estrogen suffice, whereas microgram amounts of progesterone and milligram amounts of DHEA are produced. But picogram amounts of estrogen are produced daily. So this is a potentially dangerous and toxic chemical, and the body has many layers that it puts between that active molecule and the cell systems that are being affected by it. And if those layers of protection are not working properly because of your genetics or because of your environment or because of your food, then giving a hormone is, I think, potentially a very dangerous undertaking.
So let's now talk a little bit about the delivery system, because I know that there is still a lot of question as to what's the best way of introducing hormones when you're doing replacement therapy. Is it oral? Is it vaginal? Is it some kind of transdermal? What's your opinion on this first pass detoxification based on route of administration? Do you have a thought as to what is the best way of administering these hormones?
Yes, I do. I think some hormones are safer to take orally, but the way glands administer hormones is directly into the circulation. So something that administers the hormone more directly into the circulation without as much metabolic transformation would be more physiologic. And because this is so complex, because these hormones dance with each other, the levels are constantly changing, I am very humble about my ability to mimic Mother Nature. But I try. I try to do the best I can to do it the way Mother Nature does it. So with estrogen, I think there is good data now that says transdermal estrogens are much safer than oral estrogens, partly because you don't get a first pass effect through the liver, and partly because you can administer one-tenth of the dose. I think progesterone, because it is rapidly metabolized both into downstream hormones and into metabolites, some of which are active, like allopregnanolone, which is a brain-active chemical that is calming, because progesterone disappears so rapidly, it's very easy to get the impression that you can give very high doses of progesterone, and because it doesn't change the levels of progesterone, it's perfectly safe. But in fact, you better be measuring some of those downstream hormones and making sure that you're not changing the level of estrogen or the level of testosterone when you give high doses of progesterone. So I tend to prefer the bioidentical hormones, and I prefer the transdermal route. And then you get into the trouble of how do you get women to absorb transdermally, and some women don't absorb very well transdermally. Then you can go to a vaginal route of administration, but the vaginal route of administration, you absorb much more rapidly. In fact, I see estradiol given transvaginally doesn't change the estradiol level very much, but boy, it runs up the 2-16-hydroxy metabolites significantly, and I think that could potentially be an issue in women with breast cancer, for instance.
So you also raised the question of chronobiology, and as we know, hormones are secreted, as you've indicated, more on a pulsatile basis, not statically throughout the day. Do you try to mimic that cycle when you have women administer bioidentical hormones, or do you do it in a static dosing regime?
Well, if you mean the day-to-day, minute-to-minute pulsations, I don't think we can mimic that because I don't think anyone's ever been able to document what those look like. So I know that from day-to-day, estrogen levels will fluctuate dramatically, but I don't know if they're fluctuating from second-to-second or from minute-to-minute or from hour-to-hour, and I don't think there's any administration technique that mimics a fluctuation along those lines. So I admit that I'm giving a hormone once, sometimes twice a day, and getting a curve that doesn't look much like physiology. But until somebody makes the delivery system that does that, or documents for me what levels I should be getting fluctuations of, I have to go with a cruder system. As far as the fluctuation of the hormones across the month, I think the evidence is when you have premenopausal levels of estrogen, it is safer to give progesterone in a sequential manner. But when you have normal postmenopausal levels of estrogen, and I emphasize normal postmenopausal levels, The progesterone is supposed to come from the adrenals. It's already there. You probably don't have to administer progesterone at all as long as your adrenals are healthy. But then, how many women in our culture have healthy adrenals after menopause? I don't know, but I don't think it's a lot. Mm-hmm. So, yes, if you're not making enough progesterone from the adrenals, you'd better add that in. And then what happens to it? If you've got the enzymes upregulated to make stress hormones, you're going to put progesterone in and get cortisol out. So all these things have to come into play. If you're not working on stress reduction with that woman, you're going to put a lot of progesterone in and get a lot of cortisol out.
So now we ask the question about form of dose. We've obviously heard a lot in this field about compounds or formulations such as Biast or Triast. Do you have any kind of inclination as to what is the best formulation to be using?
I think estrone and estriol are part of the normal metabolism of estradiol. So I don't think you have to put them in. I think if you put estradiol in, it's going to get converted very rapidly to estrone. If you have estrone, it's going to get sulfated to estrone sulfate. And then it's also going to get bound to sex hormone binding globulin. And then it's going to get converted to 2-16-hydroxyestrogen, and the 16-hydroxyestrogen is going to get converted to estriol. A lot of people think you should administer all three of those, thinking that if you can create a healthy balance of those three chemicals, that you will decrease the risk of, say, breast cancer. But I think that healthy balance comes from the cytochrome P450 enzymes that are metabolizing estradiol, not from the level of estrone, estriol, and estradiol. So what you want to do, if you want to have the correct balance of those three, is not administer some artificial balance of them, but work on the metabolism so that you're metabolizing them appropriately.
Well, given that, then I think my next question follows very logically, and that is, in your experience, what role does diet have influencing these hormones, this dance of hormones that you're describing, things like lignin, isoflavones, omega-3 fatty acids, enteric bacterial function? Is this a major player?
It has everything to do with it. As you've taught me, we bathe our genetics in the food we eat. If we're eating food that our genetics evolved with to create a healthy organism and to create healthy aging, our genetics are going to listen to that food and metabolize these hormones appropriately, and we're not going to see the problems. It's only when you eat the standard American diet, which is high in carbohydrates, high in chemicals, high in empty calories, and low in vegetable proteins, lignans, isoflavones, all of the things that you just listed, that we get into these aberrant ways of metabolizing these hormones that produce problems.
I was very intrigued, I'm sure you were as well, about the paper that appeared in JAMA a couple of years ago showing a statistically significant increase in breast cancer in women who had repetitive antibiotic exposure. It certainly argues for a gut hormone connection, I would say, through that data.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are a number of pathogens in the gastrointestinal tract which affect beta-glucuronidase, and glucuronidation of estrogen is one of the three main phase 2 detoxification pathways, along with methylation, which we really need to be paying attention to given how many people have problems with methylation and activation of B vitamins, and sulfation, given the number of people who don't have enough sulfate groups in their diet or can't access those sulfate groups because they have genetic abnormalities in sulfation.
So that then leads to a clinical challenge that I know you deal with all the time in this personalization of hormone therapy in women that really need it, and that's the body composition issue, because we recognize that high levels of adipocyte hypertrophy can increase these adipocytokines, which then increase regional cortisol. They influence insulin signaling. They have effect on inflammatory mediators, and they also influence the production of the 4-hydroxyestrogen. So how do you handle hormone replacement in women who have, say, elevated percent body fat?
Well, the first thing is that we have a very aggressive program at True North to get those women on a diet that helps them to lose weight and that helps them to create a healthier metabolism. So we don't just say, well, you should go lose weight, and then leave them hanging out to dry. We give them programs, we give them information, we give them consultation, we do bioimpedance analysis to show them how they're doing. We have cooking classes to really show them what it looks like when you're eating good food and how fabulous the food can taste. So we have a lot of support to change that situation of obesity. Then there's the big problem of obesity that I see in women at midlife, which is really stress. And we have a number of programs that help people to deal with stress, mindfulness-based stress reduction, yoga, meditation, heart math. There are a panoply of ideas out there if you can get patients to understand that their obesity is related to their stress and their stress is important to change now at midlife. Because if you change those patterns of behavior at midlife when you really have your body yelling at you to do that, then you're going to be able to modulate your stress according to your adrenal reserves for the rest of your life, which in my opinion is why women live a long time.
You've given me a variety of very important insights, one of which has to do with breast density and lobular structure of the breast and how that might individualize relative risk in certain women. Is this an area that you also look at as a risk factor and deal with in terms of personalization of the program for a woman?
Well, I think the differentiation of the breast, which occurs under the influence of the hormones of pregnancy and lactation, do allow a woman to go through a period of increased risk, but eventually get to a situation of decreased risk for breast cancer. So if she goes through that period of increased risk and then out to decreased risk when she's young, she's much less likely to get breast cancer. If she goes through it in her late 30s or 40s, she's got more abnormal cells that she may stimulate into a cancer. However, if she gets beyond the first year or two after the pregnancy without getting a breast cancer, then she's got the same protection that a younger woman would have from having a baby. And that protection is that the terminal ducts become lobular ducts, which then are resistant to the growth stimulation that produces ductal breast cancers. It's beginning to look like the progestin issue is related to lobular cancers. So those lobules may continue to be able to be stimulated by progestins or progesterone, and that's part of what I'm beginning to be really interested in about the differences between premenopausal and postmenopausal administration of progesterone. And the difference in administration of progesterone in normal cells versus cancer cells, or precancerous cells perhaps, and the influence of progesterone on the non-hormonal growth factors like EGF, IGF-1, and insulin, which I think are clearly a factor in the production of breast cancers in women.
So with all of this in mind, which you've done a marvelous job of summarizing for us, what is a good assessment panel that you would recommend for women? I know a lot of women think, well, mammography I'll follow serially to see if there's any relative risk, or maybe it's vaginal cytology, or maybe it's chemistries like a 216 estrogen quotient. What do you do to help women allay some of their fear or to give them kind of a longitudinal assessment profile?
Well, I do recommend mammograms, although clearly mammograms are not prevention, they are early diagnosis. And there's a lot of false positives in mammography, so it's not an ideal form of risk assessment. Family history is important, but a family history, there are two sides of that. One are the low-frequency, high-penetrance genes like the BRCA breast cancer gene. And the other are the high-frequency, low-penetrance genes like the cytochrome P450 enzymes, the glutathione transferase enzyme, COMT-transferase, MTHFR, which if you stack enough of them up against yourself, you're going to have as high a risk of breast cancer as maybe as high as a woman with a BRCA gene. What I love about that is the BRCA gene, you can't change. You've got that gene, you're stuck with it. But the high-frequency, low-penetrance genes are amenable to change. They're amenable to modifying with diet, lifestyle, exercise, and stress reduction. So instead of just sitting on the railroad track waiting for the train, you can move off onto the siding and let the train go past you. And I really like that image. So I tell women, you know, if you've noticed that the light at the end of the tunnel is a train, it's time to start getting off on the siding. So I will do the 2 to 16 hydroxy metabolites, and then I also, if I can get patients to buy into having more information about their genetics, I will get a genomic profile that gives me some of these high-frequency, low-penetrance genes. And then women sort of feel like they've taken charge. They've taken control of their metabolism and their genetics and their lives, and they're not just sitting on the track waiting to be hit.
So my concluding question, which could be obviously a question that would open in for hours of discussion, I know that you have more than enough resources to fill those hours, but I think we need to summarize. If a person's listening to this and they're saying, you know, I've been doing hormone replacement therapy, and now you've raised a lot of questions, and now I'm not as sure about what I was doing before because you've opened up all sorts of new perspectives that I wasn't considering before, what would be your recommendation? How do you get down the road to feel comfortable in the way that you're managing women?
Well, I would say if you feel that way after hearing this, you're a very smart physician. I think this is a very complex area, and we've been far too casual about it. Going through the Robert Wilson era and then the era of where we gave hormones to everyone and nobody had done the proper studies to know that we were producing problems for women should be a lesson to us about how carefully we should tread when we are changing hormones. Because all these hormones dance with each other. You change one, you're changing potentially all of them. So I would say you need to have a logical reason to know why that hormone should be replaced. You know, has the gland been removed? Is it being destroyed by antibodies? If not, why isn't it producing the way it ought to be? I have no problem with transiently mucking around in it, you know, changing the levels of hormones in order to get a woman sleeping, for instance, so you can get her adrenals calmed down, or in order to deal with issues that are related to her thyroid until you get the toxins out of her environment. I don't have a problem with that as long as you are simultaneously working on the whole picture in the background to get her healthier. Otherwise, I think, you know, you may be kidding yourself that you're increasing her longevity by adding some of these hormones in, as we found out with the Women's Health Initiative.
Well, I want to thank you. I'm saying what is clearly obvious. Your patients are very privileged to have access to True North and your skill. I would like to think that we could form a functionally based medicine where these opportunities would be available throughout the whole of the country. But we really appreciate you sharing with us what I think is a very thoughtful and rational perspective on this whole concept of bioidentical hormone replacement. We wish you the very best and look forward to visiting with you again, Bethany, real soon.
Thanks, Jeff, and thanks for all the wonderful information that I've received from you and that you've put out into the world. It really has changed my life. If my patients are benefiting, it's because of what I've gotten from functional medicine.
Well, thank you very much.
As part of our new format for 2007 for Functional Medicine Update, we're finishing each issue with questions and answers from you, the listener participants. And we have an interesting start of this question, which relates to the sulfites in red wine as the cause of the red wine headache syndrome. This is a specific question to a more general theme that I'd like to speak to. We've often attributed this sulfite-related headaches to an allergy-like response because individuals have inabilities to properly metabolize sulfite. So that begs the question, how does sulfite get metabolized? And it's done so through an enzyme called sulfite oxidase. Sulfite oxidase is a molybdenum-containing enzyme. And as a consequence, this is one of the few examples where molybdenum is a essential nutrient for physiological function. So in the case where an individual has a sulfite oxidase genetic slow spot, then it would indicate that they may need to either remove the sulfites from their diet or to increase the molybdenum content of their diet through a nutritional supplement or foods. Generally around 200 to 300 micrograms of molybdenum is considered to be in the safe and effective range. And we can't say that all individuals with molybdenum supplementation alone will get benefit, so that may also be reducing the sulfite load from the food as well. We also recognize that vitamin B6 plays a role in this sulfite oxidase pathway as well, so sometimes the administration of B6 along with molybdenum and magnesium will help to eliminate or at least reduce the sulfite sensitivity. But again, in extreme cases of sensitivity, even small doses can produce very large physiologic responses, so clearly the person needs to be very cautious about sulfite exposure. Beyond sulfite, however, in red wine, there is another series of phytochemicals that often mimic what people think to be sulfite sensitivity, and these are the ethylamines, like phenylethylamine, which is a dopamine-like conjugate. And these particular amine-like compounds, organic amines, are vasoconstrictive and can induce then vascular changes, including small vessel changes and produce headaches. So one of the other things that we see in red wine, cheese, chocolate, and in bananas are these phenethylamine-like compounds, which then require monoamine oxidase as the detoxifying enzyme. And again, as we recognize, if you look at MAO inhibiting drugs, there is a package insert that says, while you're on these medications, to be cautious about consuming these foods that contain these amine-like substances. The reason for it is that the vascular response could produce headaches. So if you have a genetic polymorphism of monoamine oxidase, that makes that a slow step in its detoxification of amine-like substances that come from food, then you're more sensitive to these foods in a normal diet, of which red wine may be another member of that family because it contains these ethylamine-like substances. So I don't believe we should jump to the conclusion that headaches only come from that of sulfite. They can also come from these bioactive amines, and of course they can also come from the overuse of alcohol as well, so we should probably throw that in there as it pertains to the response to any alcoholic beverage. In the case specifically of red wine-induced headaches, however, I think it's probably a combination of sulfite sensitivity. As you know, in asthmatics, there's an increased risk to sulfite sensitivity. This tends to be a covariable constitutional issue, and so you generally have a higher level of red wine sensitivity in asthmatics, and we know that sulfite sensitivity includes symptoms of skin rash, redness, hives, itching, flushing, and tingling. But we also recognize that these can be associated with other vasoactive substances. So differentiation of red wine syndrome as a headache probably is more related to that of the phenylethylamines. Red wine syndrome as it relates to flushing and to the vasomotor effects are probably more related to the sulfite. So I would differentiate those two classes of responses to wine or chocolate or bananas or cheese, the sulfites being more the skin erythemas and the kind of hives and itching, and the problems related to headaches more coming from the bioactive amines. And this is clearly an indication of unique detoxification, again, through monoamine oxidase. So it means that person is less able to metabolize their adrenaline as well. So they're more sensitive to states of hyperadrenaline, like stress. So all of this kind of fits together in a pattern, I believe, that is related to both lifestyle, diet, and specific nutrients for modulating these pathways. I hope that's helpful in answering that question, and please do send in your questions. Email them into our website, jeffreybland.com, and we'll be pleased to put the answers onto the next issues. And that concludes the February issue of 2007.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by Synthesis LLC by Dr. Jeffrey Bland. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.